Spirit Radio Podcasts.
Well, in a response to the ongoing, just really dark and abusive comments that have been made and directed at author J.K. Rowling, our next guest co-wrote a letter supporting her and responding to this online abuse, and it was published in the Sunday Times. On the line to tell us more about why abuse is being directed at J.K. Rowling in the first place, and indeed just the impact of this online abuse and why she wrote part of this letter, we have psychotherapist and author Stella O'Malley. Stella, good morning to you.
Hi there.
Okay, so what is the background to this? Why is abuse being directed at J.K. Rowling?
Yeah, people could be forgiven for not having a clue because it's complicated. So it all began really with a person who is called Pippa Bunce and Philip Bunce. And this person identifies as a man half the week and as a woman the other half of the week. So one half the week Pippa is called Pippa Bunce, the other half the week they're called Philip Bunce. And they use whatever pronouns that goes with the Pippa or the Philip. And Pippa, as such, won some sort of award to do with kind of Businesswoman of the Year. And there was another woman called Maya Forster, who's a tax expert, and she works for a think tank. And she has a very serious career. And she described Pippa Bunce as a man in a dress. She wasn't happy that Pippa was going for this award and winning it. And she described Pippa as a man in a dress and, as a result, lost her job. And as a result, brought a case of unfair dismissal, and she lost. And the day she lost the court case, which cost her obviously a lot of money to bring this, J.K. Rowling last December tweeted in support of Maya. And she said something along the lines of, dress however you please, wear whatever you want, but don't tell me sex isn't real. I support Maya. The point she was trying to make, J.K., and making it better than I'll ever make, I suppose, was that, you know, Pippa Bunce was born biologically male.
She was trying to state a biological fact in a kind of pithy way, right?
She was, exactly. And she got a massive amount of abuse, a massive amount of pushback, a massive amount, very, very dark, incredibly sexualized, an awful lot of rape comments, an awful lot of murder comments. And it's really noticeable when men are abused, they say, you know, get rid of his job. When women are abused, they're saying murder her, rape her, and get rid of her job. And so J.K. Rowling didn't play very much for a few months. I'd say was very shocked by the level of the vitriol and the poison that was directed towards her. And then a few months later, around about May, came out again. And this time she came out on foot of a couple of minor points about what are they called? Hygiene products, companies of hygiene products, said women and people who menstruate. And she kind of made a kind of joke along the lines of only women menstruate.
Again, another biological fact.
Yes. And again, was absolutely destroyed for it. She fenced back and forth with that. And I wrote an article in the Sunday Times around about them because literally I couldn't repeat the abuse she got because it was that dark and it was that offensive. And the words they were using. And it was thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people who were piling on. And then more came. And that's what I'm saying. It's very complicated. She released a book about 2 weeks ago. And it's a 900-page book. It's a thriller. In Troubled Blood, I think it's called. And you know the way she uses a pseudonym. And it's interesting. You know, she called herself J.K. Rowling because she was told, as a woman, children won't buy your book. Boys won't buy your book. And so she changed from Joanne Rowling to J.K. Rowling way back in the day before Harry Potter was released. And she also pens under a pseudonym of Robert Galbraith. So she kind of knows her, you know, she's been around a long time around women's issues. And so she released this 900-page book. And within that 900 pages, there's one sentence that refers to a man, the serial killer of the book, who dressed in a coat and in a dress sometime in the 70s. So at one point in the 1970s, there's a reference to that man dressed as a woman. And that's not, by the way, that's not transgender, that's a cross-dresser, which neither be here nor there. But anyway, trans activists and extremists and people who really haven't read many books or thought about this very much, they piled on her, and there's an extraordinary campaign where it was RIP, the hashtag was RIP J.K. Rowling, for days. All because she dared to include one sentence in a 900-page book. And that sentence referenced a cross-dresser and a serial killer in the same sentence.
Is there two parts to be kind of worried about here, Stella? Obviously, on the one hand, the online abuse is really, really shocking. And it's interesting just you raising the issue of the difference and how it's directed towards women and men. But the other thing that is a big issue is that, and I know that J.K. Rowling, along with 150 other academics and writers, wrote a letter recently just talking about freedom of speech, because really she's trying to talk about an issue that is important, does deserve debate. But that free speech and debate is being stifled. I mean, she's still, you know, brave enough to put her opinion out there. But you could understand how on this issue that, because there's so much public shaming and ostracism, that it would stop people from, that you can't even ask a question or you can't even state a biological fact. How dangerous is that?
Yeah, we're seem to be living in a world where self-censorship is ruling everything. And George Orwell, way back in the day when he was writing 1984 and stuff, he said self-censorship is the biggest threat. When you self-censor, then the entire kind of concept of free speech gets dismantled. Because if we're all self-censoring, we don't know we're all self-censoring. And it was very interesting in Berlin in 1989, when the wall came down, it turned out that the vast majority didn't agree with the Stasi. It turned out that they didn't agree with the status quo, but everybody was afraid to say it. And this is kind of what's happened with the J.K. Rowling letter. I wrote it and with another person, and we kind of asked other writers, and loads of people like Ian McEwan, Lionel Shriver, Alexander Armstrong, really big names, Ben Miller, and John Cleese just yesterday, Tony Robinson, huge, that was Baldrick back in the day, jumped on and signed the letter to defend J.K. Rowling and to be very, to stand in solidarity with J.K. Rowling, and also to kind of attack the concept of online abuse that is happening. Like, Caroline Flack died of suicide, and I know there's all sorts of conversations around her, but she did die of suicide as a result of online abuse. It feels that this was a kind of an inevitable scenario in that case. We need to be very careful. Not that I'm saying on any level that J.K. Rowling's in danger of abuse. What I'm worried about, and J.K. Rowling is worried about, what about all the other women who aren't uncancellable? Because J.K. Rowling is one of the very, very few people who can do this. Everybody else would be cancelled.
And when you give the example at the outset, Stella, of that businesswoman who, by merely saying, I'm kind of annoyed, this is an award for business women, you know, and and I would imagine that there could be other businesswomen who were a bit irritated like that, but they're going, well, I don't want to lose my job,
You don't need to imagine it. I know. I've met many of them. Yes, there are. You're dead right. And there are. And there's an awful lot of them, and an awful lot of them are silencing themselves, and they're being silenced. And they're told, ironically, to be kind. They need to be kind, and they need to stop saying it because it makes other people feel bad. And I would say, well, actually, the truth is what makes a progressive society better. We need to deal with truth, and we need to deal with openness and honesty and transparency. We can't live in a world where people are self-censoring, because it's too dangerous, because we don't know who's saying what. But nicely, we opened up the letter. So if any of your listeners want to sign, they can. You just look for In Solidarity with J.K. Rowling. And we made it a petition because it was such an onslaught, and I'm exhausted. So it was published in the Sunday Times on Sunday, and it was an onslaught of emails of people saying, well, I'm a writer, could you add my name? And then everybody was just saying, well, could you add my name? And now there's over 12,000 or in and around, I don't know, I'm not keeping up with the numbers, about 12,000 signatures on our petition. And we only released it a day ago or 36 hours ago, and there's over 12,000 signatures. So it's been huge of people standing in solidarity with J.K. Rowling and signing their name on the petition. Which is lovely.
But it's interesting really to see, isn't it, when someone can sign their name to a petition, Stella, and they're going, okay, I'm not going to get a backlash of abuse if I kind of like or retweet her tweet that kind of just states a biological fact.
They will, though, because two people have already got a backlash. One person was a good writer. She's written many books, called Amanda Craig, and she was taken off a panel of judges yesterday because she had written this letter in solidarity with J.K. Rowling. If you read the letter, because it was in the Sunday Times, but it's easily available online, it's on my Twitter if anybody wants to read it, or on my Facebook, you'll see all we're talking about is online abuse and misogynistic abuse. And to say that's a problem for Mislexia, is the organisation, and they're a women's organisation, but they took Amanda Craig off the judging panel because they felt it wasn't kind. even though the entire letter, if you read it out, I swear to God, there is not a word you could say wasn't kind. It was just saying, we're worried about the online abuse and the misogynistic abuse that is directed to J.K. Rowling, and we stand with J.K. Rowling. That's the basically guts of the letter. And somebody else as well, I don't want to say who, but another woman I know has also been hurt professionally since literally the last 48 hours.
So what do we need to do, Stella? I mean, even from, you know, just a common sense perspective of trying to get a rein in on this, where people should be able to just freely speak, have free speech without fear of being losing their jobs, especially on issues that are really important for us to discuss and talk about openly and respectfully.
I think there's two things we need to do. I think people who are engaging in online abuse mindlessly really need to take a look at themselves, a hard look at themselves. If you have kind of tweeted or messaged or supported any sort of kind of dark message on those lines, don't. Make sure you know what you're talking about, because it's a very dark thing to do and it's a very insidious thing to do. And a lot of people must have done it because it was trending for days, this RIP J.K. Rowling. And the second thing we need to do is start speaking up our truth and not being afraid to say the truth, because the truth is the best thing we can offer in society. And if you can just say your truth with, you know, with decency and consideration, that's enough. Integrity really matters, and I think it's time for people to stop self-censoring. George Orwell really hit the nail on the head when he said, that's the biggest threat. It's not the police, it's our own self-censorship. And that's what's happening now. It's extraordinary to watch it play out. It feels like people took the manual of 1980, took the book 1984, and they're using it as a manual. The way it's so censored these days.
Yeah, well, Stella, thanks so much for you speaking your truth and sharing it with us this morning and not being afraid to do so. Thanks for joining us on the programme today. That's psychotherapist and author Stella O'Malley there. And Stella mentioned that petition. If you want to sign it, it's in, if you just Google In Solidarity with J.K. Rowling petition, you'll see it there and you can read it and see if you agree with it. COVID-19 has impacted so many areas of society, but one of the things that you mightn't have thought about is just the impact that it has on various areas of medical research. Did you know that one person in Ireland dies every hour from cancer? A figure which Breakthrough Cancer Research says tragically will increase because things like cancer screenings have been delayed, treatments have been delayed, and research has pretty much stopped in so many areas. And they've lost so many months because of COVID-19. Well, our next guest's field of work in cancer research has seen some research also having to be put on hold, which could affect people's time. And, you know, I just picture anybody who sits in front of a doctor when they're told, when they're given a difficult diagnosis, a cancer diagnosis, what's probably one of the first questions they'll ask? How much time have I got? Well, their latest campaign to mark Cancer Week Ireland is all about buying back time, and they're going to be telling us a little bit about this as well as just some of the impacts of COVID-19. It's great to have Orla Dolan, the CEO of Breakthrough Cancer Research, on the line. Orla, good morning to you.
Good morning, Wendy.
So tell us a little bit about some of the setbacks in terms of the impact that you've seen on cancer research and indeed cancer care during COVID-19.
Well, I suppose it can't be a shock to any of your listeners to, you know, to think back to March when the whole country shut down and everybody kind of went to their homes and everybody kind of stayed out of the public eye or went to their workplaces. Well, that was also true for researchers. And so many of our researchers who work in laboratories across all the universities would have been kind of locked out of the labs for 5 to 6 months at a time. And so I suppose it's no, like as you mentioned earlier, time is the enemy of research, and everything we're doing is about accelerating the pace of that research so the new treatment you're developing gets to the patient as quick as you can. So on a very basic level, people were just unable to go into the lab and do their work. But also you had the implications of, you know, projects that involved patient samples having to be thrown out halfway through an experiment, other projects that required patient samples not starting. You had clinical trials that we had that were, you know, up and running that had to be paused. And I mean, that was, I suppose, just a couple of examples of how the impact of COVID had on research, which is already kind of trying to make up the time for patients, you know.
And is that still happening at the moment, or has research been able to resume yet?
So research has been able to resume with some restrictions, like in all workplaces, you know, there's less people around and people have worked very hard. I mean, it's nobody's fault that people were locked out. I kind of want to say that in that everybody had to kind of redress the way that we work together or interact with each other. And it was all about trying to keep people safe. It's just the ramifications of that are 5 or 6 or 7 months of loss of time physically standing at a lab bench doing your work. I mean, now some of those things have opened, but even screenings and things like that, which, you know, are to get the early diagnosis of patients on the care side, you know, some of them are opening, others are opening up slowly.
But there's still been, there's months of delay and a backlog. And what could that mean, Orla? I mean, if you're waiting for, as I am, by the way, if you're waiting for a cervical smear and you're meant to get it and you might be waiting 3 or 4 months, if you have an issue, that 3 or 4 months of a wait could be the difference between life and death.
Yeah, I mean, look, in all cancers, what you want to do is diagnose as early as you possibly can, because you get the greater chance of dealing with the cancer in a before it has spread. And so I suppose the concern is, and they've even modelled it in the UK, that they think there'll be, you know, 20% more deaths in the UK that, be due to the kind of disruption in services and screening and diagnostics. And so, you know, in the patient, at the hospital level, yes, screening and these things are getting back up and running, but are not fully. Even when they're up fully, there'll be less people able to come in. But also, even the public, I suppose, themselves have, self-stopped themselves from going to the GP office. You know, they didn't want to be a burden on the healthcare system. You're afraid to go to the GP office because you don't want to catch COVID from somebody else. You know, so, you know, what we would also urge is, if you have any concerns, go do something about it. But on the other side, I suppose, we do have concerns that there will be an impact of this time. You know, it's not like anybody did anything on purpose. It's just, this is the nature of the impact of COVID on all of our society. And I suppose the point we're making is, really, research is the only way we're going to make back up the time we've lost and find the treatments that will save people. Because, you know, we already have 9,000 people in Ireland who die from cancer every year, and we need new treatments for them. We're now going to have probably more. And so what we need to do is keep funding research, because that's the only way we're going to have an impact on that number.
And do we need to work on, or like, getting the balance right then? I mean, when you give those numbers, 9,000 people a year, obviously it's a lot more than have died from COVID, and the fear is that those numbers will increase, like you've said. Are we getting to a place where we're getting that balance back? Because the treatment of cancer and cancer research is just as much of an emergency, if not more, in terms of the, if you're just talking about the number of deaths and COVID.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose we would say, you know, cancer hasn't gone away during COVID, and neither can we. And so if you look at it, it's a health emergency that we can have an impact on. We can have an impact on by, you know, paying attention to our own bodies and doing something about it if we feel we have any concerns, but also investing in research so we have new treatments to come out. I think, look, you look at COVID, we're all sitting around. I mean, we've never been more reminded of the fragility of ourselves as a human race. And what are we doing? We're sitting waiting for researchers to come up with a vaccine so we can get back to what is our normal life. You know, that's what cancer patients are waiting for all the time. I mean, we have made huge strides. And so certain cancers like breast, prostate and testicular cancer have survival rates now in the upper 80s and 90% survival.
And what would that have been, you know, 20, 30 years ago?
Yeah. And like, that would have been half that in some of their cases about 40 years ago. But we have a whole raft of other cancers which would be considered poorer prognosis cancers that haven't seen the same improvement. So pancreatic cancer has been about 9% survival for 50 years. And so we're working on those kind of cancers already. And we need to keep going, because, you know, we can't be distracted from the fact that long after COVID is gone, we still have this challenge that we have to face. And, you know, the last thing you want to have, as you mentioned at the beginning, is, you know, my own father died of cancer, and you thought the day that he was diagnosed with cancer was, you know, the worst day, a kick in the gut and utterly shocking for our family. But that wasn't the worst day. It was the day they brought us in as a family and told us there was nothing left to try. And that's the day that researchers take away. It's that day that we don't want to have a situation where there's nothing to be offered to a patient that's going to give them the time that they deserve, you know?
So what sort of research, this campaign, the Buy Back Time campaign, is trying to say, okay, we need to double down our efforts now because of the time you've lost from the research perspective. What are you working on at the moment?
So what we would do is we put clinicians and scientists together, and we ask them to kind of answer the challenges that are kind of faced in the clinic. And so we're looking for, like, you know, ways to overcome cancers that have become resistant to treatment. We are looking for ways to offer alternatives to surgery where patients might be able to have surgery because they have other conditions, their age or the location of their tumor. we're looking at ways that we can boost the immune system. Immunotherapies have been like this exploding area in terms of cancer treatment and offered a really new avenue to treat patients. But unfortunately, while it works phenomenally well for some patients, it's still only 20 to 30% of those patients. So we need to find out why it's not working for the others and get a way for that to be working for more patients. So we really tend to focus on those cancers that have survival that is less than 20% now. That's what we, where we need to have the investment. We want 100% survival for 100% of cancers. And what we do is we'll talk to the clinicians, tell us who are the patients and what are the cancers that they can't help now with the current treatments available. And then we go back to the researchers and say, find a solution for them. And let's get it to the out of the bench and to those patients as quickly as we can. And that's kind of what buyback time is. We need to buy back the time we've lost and, you know, make that time up. But we also need to look at creating the time that we've missed. COVID has taken from us birthdays and celebrations, but that's what we want for all those cancer patients in the future. We want a future where they have Christmases and birthdays and all those things we've been missing now long into the future. And we believe research is the way to do it.
Research is a really important part of that. Is another important part, Orla, the education piece. And I remember around the time of the cervical smear scandal where, you know, at the time it was, but we also need to understand that the other symptoms to look out for, you know, whether you've had a test or not. And I'm sure that's true of other cancers as well, you know, things to look out for. Are we doing enough on that side of things?
I mean, we are actually, after joining with a group, we're a founding member of a group called the Irish Cancer Prevention Network with the National Cancer Control Programme, Mary Keating and the Irish Cancer Society. And what we're doing is a lot of education now on how you can lower your own risk and what are the signs and symptoms to look out for in all cancers. I think, look, we can take control over some things. We need to be more active. We need to have a healthier diet. It's obvious we shouldn't be smoking. You know, we need to protect our skin by not exposing ourselves to UV. But we also need to kind of know our own bodies. The challenge from some cancers like ovarian or pancreatic or some, these symptoms are kind of like a pain in my back or cramps in my stomach or things like that, which can often be confused. But I don't know how many patients can kind of say when they look back, oh, I probably actually had something, you know, I wasn't feeling great. These were the reasons why, but I didn't understand what it was. And I suppose we need to be getting a bit more proactive. And I think, you know, as I go back to the part earlier on, one of the kind of concerns during COVID is that people have been avoiding going to the doctor and avoiding, you know, going in about symptoms that they have where they don't feel quite right, because sometimes they just don't want to burden the healthcare system, which is under pressure at the moment. But the earlier you catch anything, the better you will always do. And so if you have any concerns or if you just don't feel right, go and get it checked out. I mean, what have you got to lose? And if it's a cancer and it gets caught earlier, isn't that a better way to go?
Orla, thank you so much for joining us on the programme this morning and indeed for the work that Breakthrough Cancer Research is doing. That's Orla Dolan, the CEO of Breakthrough Cancer Research. And if you want to support their work, you can go to their website, breakthroughcancerresearch.ie/buybacktime, if you want to find out about the campaign. Or a very easy way to donate is text BCOR to 50300 and you will donate €4 to that campaign. Wow, what about the clothes that you wore as a child? You have many hand-me-downs. My mother slagged me when Christopher, my second boy, was born because she said, I bet one of the first things you thought was great. I don't have to go and buy any more new clothes. And it is, it's brilliant just to be able to use all the hand-me-downs. And one of the things I love doing with when friends have babies is to be able to give them the giant bag of labelled clothes and kind of pass them along. Well, our next guest, her experience was she bought a new outfit for a child, but then realised there were still clothes in the wardrobe that had never been worn and kind of started thinking, well, hey, this is a bit of a waste. And she decided, what can I do about it? On the line to tell us more about her new business venture, which is called Little Things, which is all about making small changes, and it's about also trying to help the environment as well. We've got Laura Grant on the line. Laura, morning to you.
Hi Wendy, how are you? Thanks for having me on today. I'm delighted to be here to talk to you.
So what about you? Did you get much hand-me-down clothes when you were growing up as a child?
Oh, listen, so I think when I was growing up, and I have a confession to make, so I'm a child of the 70s and I'm also the youngest of 8 kids, so it was definitely a house where clothes were passed down from one to the other. Like, this was the total norm at the time. And to be honest with you, I don't really remember getting new clothes apart from Easter and Christmas. Like, uniforms definitely didn't count. Apart from these magically, beautifully wrapped parcels that my two aunts who lived in the UK would send us. Like, brand new clothes were the exception rather than the rule. But clothes, I think, at the time were relatively much more expensive. And they probably would have been made in Ireland, countries like the UK, etc. You know, so, yeah, clothing was much different then. So I think in the last 20 years or so, we've just seen a huge drop in the prices of clothes that has allowed us to buy more and more clothes. And on the one hand, that feels great. But it's estimated now that we have about five times more clothes than our grandparents. But I think, to be honest, you mentioned your own little boy, Christopher, there. I think that, you know, you and probably people listening will probably think that their kids have even more than that again. And it's mind-boggling. And you mentioned my own light bulb moments that I had about, you know, clothing, and particularly, you know, how I kind of turned to pre-loved clothes. And this is when my youngest, I have three kids, and my youngest, Grace, she's nearly three now, I had her on, you know, on one hip, and I was trying to wedge, you know, as you mentioned, yet another little outfit into the wardrobe.
Shoving it in there as there's so many things piling up, yeah.
You know, Wendy, like, I mean, I was just trying to cram it in, and I saw all these tags, and I just felt that moment of guilt that I think a lot of us feel. We want our kids to be beautifully turned out, but there's that mismatch between, like, what we're doing and what we're trying to, you know, do for the environment, and we're all getting this message about sustainability all the time, but it's how, you know, one doesn't really match with the other. So I thought to myself, like, what am I doing? Why am I buying these clothes? And there, you mentioned about passing clothes on to, you know, your friends' kids, which is fantastic. Like, these clothes could be passed on to other kids who could wear them. They'd look, you know, cute and cool, you know, and they'd have a real impact on my own family because we'd have more space and we'd feel good about what we were doing. But also the community, because we'd be reducing our waste and our own environmental footprint. So what I started to do was I made a commitment to myself. I'd try and buy pre-loved clothes where I could. So I started doing that, you know.
And where did you find them, Laura?
Yeah, so I just did a bit of a Google search. So, you know, there's Facebook groups, there's, you know, individual online sellers, there's lots of, you know, like, websites, you know, that deal in pre-loved items. So I'd have to go to a Facebook group for my little one, you know, my older kids, because I have an 11-year-old and a 9-year-old, they're boys, you know, for their sports gear, there might be individual sellers. So I was enjoying doing it, but it was really time-consuming. And you might have to meet people in person and all that sort of stuff. So, you know, I just really enjoyed it, but it was taking up a lot of time.
Yeah, and a lot of people might be bothered. They might go, it's not worth the time. Yeah,
it's not worth it. And then selling, you know, our clothes again was a lot of work, but I absolutely loved sending the packages off. Like, you know, I kept thinking of the own packages we would get as kids, and they were beautifully wrapped, and I would send them off, you know, with a lot of love to other parents and think, oh yeah, these are going to be enjoyed and used again. So I just thought to myself, I wish this was hassle-free. And the thought of, oh wow, I just wish there was one place I could go to that, you know, I could find the clothes for my kids who were at the, you know, baby stage right up to about 9 or 10 at the time, nearly 12 now. And then I thought to myself, well, why don't I do it? You know, the idea just was born. And I said, I'm that person, I can do that. So Lovely Things, which is our new business, is just that. You know, it's quality focused, it's reliable, we're an Irish family business, and basically I won't sell clothes that are not of the quality that I wouldn't dress my own kids in. And probably, you know, if my mother-in-law was coming over, that's the ultimate quality check for me, you know. So that's what we aim to achieve, that it's hassle-free for parents, and that you can have your kids beautifully turned out in the brands that you usually buy, but you know that they are sustainably sourced. So we buy from other parents, or parents sometimes, you know, they want to donate some clothes, which is great. They're brilliant value, and you're going to receive them in zero plastic, you know, packaging. It's going to be recyclable, compostable, sourced in Ireland and made in Ireland wherever possible. So, you know, we hope that, you know, ticks a lot of boxes for parents who are listening today, or anyone who buys kids clothes in Ireland. So that could be grandparents, aunties, uncles, godparents, you know, friends who've had kids, you know, or new babies. You know, we're aiming to hopefully provide a realistic and really hassle-free and usable option to parents.
And what sort of clothes do you think parents want? Because we do live in a bit of a throwaway culture, Laura, yes, where there's kind of two tiers, certainly in my experience of thinking of the clothes that the kids have had, is you have the kind of fancy stuff that, oh my goodness, it only gets worn once or twice, but sure, then there's stuff that's really bad quality, it ends up getting holes in it, and you end up throwing it out, and obviously that's got an environmental impact as well.
Yeah, there's a friend of mine, she calls them the one wash wonders, or the disposable clothes, you know, and absolutely. So what we're trying to achieve with what we're doing is to extend the life of all clothing. So we accept all brands as long as they're in, you know, excellent condition to start off with. So we're going to have a range from everything from your high street to your high-end designer brands. We've got everything on our books, and we're building a great selection. So you've mentioned, Wendy, I suppose, what parents are looking for. So we're going to have bundles for the 0 to 4 age group. So that's 30 items for €30. So everything, you know, from vests, tops, bottoms, a piece of outerwear, like, you know, clothing, jackets, or, you know, like a hoodie, for example, you know, depending on the season, and also your occasion. They can get in touch with me or find out what we're doing on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. So we're Lovely Things on Facebook, Lovely Things by Laura on Instagram, and Lovely Things _IE on Twitter. They can also email me, and the details are all on our Facebook page. So in a nutshell, we are offering a convenient one-stop clothes from all the brands that you love. They just happen to be pre-loved. They're sustainably sourced. They're brilliant value. And they're going to be sent to you in zero waste packaging. So, you know, hopefully that'll tick a lot of boxes for people who are trying to make that jump in their mind from trying to make those changes in relation to what they buy for their kids. And also, we provide a hassle-free service to purchase your great quality kids' clothes that'll offer a return on your investment in your clothes, free up valuable space. We're all trying to, you know, find extra space in our home. And then you know that you're going to be part of a circular economy in Ireland to extend the life of clothes, which are all around us, and reduce its carbon footprint. So, I mean, it just ticks so many great boxes.
It really does. And I think the answer to a lot of parents' prayers, Laura, thanks so much for joining us on the programme today. And congratulations to you. Best of luck with your new business as well. That's Laura Grant of Little Things. As you said, they're on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, all that sort of stuff. If you want to connect up with what they're doing, maybe you're looking to think now, what can I make sure is loved once again? Or maybe you're looking for a special outfit as well.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.